stuff, and then we've been talking about actually is working with themselves within their own departments. But at the end of the day, we've got to take our results out to two layers of people. First of all, to our senior management and our boards of our firms, and then ultimately onto the regulator. And Nilesh is going to walk us through the practical issues facing reporting the results of your ICAs.
Thank you. In this brief session, hopefully we'll have a good discussion following it. Really, I just want to cover four main aspects. The first is the scope and role of the actuary and what role he may find himself in the ICA process itself. And then, although this may be a little bit like taking Coles to Newcastle, I'd just like to re-emphasize again, what is special about ICA? You know, why is it different compared to, say, reserve numbers that many of you have probably reported to the board or to management, or even a rating schedule to underwriters in terms of this is the recommended rating schedule, where do we go from here? Thirdly, in terms of the complexity of the organisation and how an organisation actually works, makes a lot of difference. In practice, I've only been involved in a relatively small organisation where quite a few members of the board are actually involved in the business directly. So that does have certain implications on what you need to take to the board and what you need to explain through. And lastly, reporting and how it connects in with GM12. I think in the initial discussions, you'll have found that our initial aim was to provide some sort of guidance. However, the subject is so new that really the only guidance that applies is GM12. So, in terms of scope, the ICA is the responsibility of the board, both to carry out the evaluation of, process and the final number that may be chosen. So, in the end, they have to be comfortable with whatever results have been derived by the group doing the ICA. One thing that I've found is you may not necessarily be responsible for the full ICA number. You may have a portion of the numbers to do, or a large portion, small portion. But because you have a quantification background, even though the strict apportionment may be small, I think there will be a heavier reliance placed on you in terms of explaining the outcomes and how the various quantitative aspects have been dealt with. So here again, we're going to, I think, a point that Peter emphasized. We as a profession, are we over-promising in certain areas? And it's important to actually be aware of that, because the involvement of an actuary can actually imply more confidence in the numbers if it's not properly communicated. So in terms of the ICA, what is special about it? The biggest thing that actually hit me was it's a relatively new process. In companies, for professionals, you know, actuaries, accountants, how do they deal with any outputs coming out of it in terms of internal audit, risk management? How do the things link in? So everyone is actually trying to see how these things link in and how information can be cross-utilized. Guidance, you know, we started off with very ambitious aims to try and give guidance and then saw the reality. You know, there's a lot of work to be done there. The biggest difference is when you look at traditional board reporting, you would see a set of projected best estimate or booked numbers, but a lot of the variables are treated in a one-way basis. So the investment committee sits on the side, and they're happy with the investment philosophy, and the yields happen to be whatever they are, the investment income enters the numbers, and off it goes. So the board is used to receiving quite a lot of one-way analysis. They know the sorts of risks we're taking on the investments, and then on the other hand, they may sort of know that an issue with reinsurance placement has arisen. But this is the first time with, as my finance director always puts it, can you join up the dots for me? It's the really first time we're trying to join up all the dots. A really bigger piece here, and in reserving, this sort of appears when we make qualitative judgments, I think, as Henry sort of pointed out, why would you exclude an outlier? You have to have very good, solid reasons, which are based on substance. Some sort of qualitative, but that substance is normally qualitative. You know, we'll never write that sort of risk again, and we all believe that always. And I think with the ICA, because it ends up in a final number, because there are so many parameters, it looks and feels more quantitative than it actually is. Whereas the key drivers are actually qualitative. Okay. And it's getting that message across in terms of both numbers and what the qualitative aspects driving those numbers are, and how the qualitative aspects relate to specific business decisions. Example here. We've seen all these presentations on changes in weather. Okay. As underwriters, do you buy into that theory or not? If you buy into that theory, you use the RMS models unadjusted, and let's say you could actually model it fairly accurately, given the model, you come out with a number. If you actually believe there's an increase in frequency, that would lead to a 20% increase in capital requirement. Now, clearly there's no right answer unless you're the person up there. And however, if as management you actually feel that there is quite a lot of substance to this, we believe these theories, then moving to the higher number or doing something else with your business is the right answer. So it's linking what, you know, what the qualitative judgment means in a quantitative fashion and expressing that, which is ultra important. And sort of to emphasize a basic point, explaining reserves sometimes is hard enough in terms of what the drivers could be, what the potential variation around it would be. And there we have a good body of data. We have a whole triangle. You know, we have trends, we have market data, etc. This is trying to put the whole caboodle together and see how it all interacts. And sparse information, you know, we haven't seen these, you know, details. These are all beliefs and judgments. And I still believe that we may all call it 1 in 200, but it actually could be 1 in 20. So there's an issue of whether we're demonstrating relative movements compared to absolute. The regulator is obviously worried about the absolute in terms of the overall. Management are probably worried more about the relative, because if the whole world has got it wrong, it seems more okay. So now moving over to size and complexity of organisations. I mean, personally, I've only dealt with a fairly small organisation where I would say the reporting is much easier than in a larger organisation. I have had some experience in larger organisation, but before regulatory requirements actually came in. So trying to explain these sorts of concepts, how it interacts. Now here, joining the dots is even more complex because the individuals will be trying to link in the numbers and the work that you've done or you've reported on to the other bits of information they see. And in different territories, in different business lines, so if you're a composite, the dynamics are different and they're all trying to link these things together. And I would actually be interested in any feedback on that. And I think on the website, if there is some substance to actually add on that, that would be very valuable for the profession. And that's partly sort of driven by the knowledge of the board members as well. In our business, quite a few are actually involved in the day-to-day running. So they're aware of what we're doing in evaluating the ICA, what impacts it, etc. So the communication gap there is a little bit easier. But where the boards are more remote from the direct operation, I think the challenge is even greater. And here again, the risk measures, if companies had already used capital modelling, the measures they may have used might be very different to the required. How do the two relate? Why do they differ? All those questions need to be set through. And again, how do they relate to target setting within the company? Because they need to relate that back to actions within the company rather than treat it as a pure number that comes out of black box process. As far as formal reporting is concerned, GN12 principles apply. So there is a need for clarity of scope and limitations. And some of the limitations are not necessarily in a written form, formal form, but just going through the issues of parameter uncertainty, model uncertainty, explaining the consequences that if the hurricane models or the underlying parameters are really shifting in this trended form, this is the implication. There's no necessary evidence to actually suggest it's moving that way, or they may be the strength, but again, presenting that information so that the appropriate judgments can be made. In terms of explaining the complexity, the only way that I think has been successful is actually relating the results back to specific actions in the business and the sensitivity of key parameters. And a lot of that is showing what happens if you are wrong in the models that you assumed, so if the hurricane models moved, if your investment model was centered on this sort of central assumption, if you are wrong and it actually moved to this, what would the number relate? And out of all that information, you will obviously have a best estimate view. The board may actually not be willing to take some of the parameter risk in the sense that, okay, the individual groups may have been very diligent in making sure that the CAT models work extremely well, but we as a board feel uncomfortable that you haven't allowed fully for the trend. We want to allow more for the trend. Or we want to restructure the business and put the trend in so that the capital remains the same. So linking it back to the business is really the only way that I've found of getting through this. There's a huge reliance on, yes, you've obviously got the numbers right. You're a quantification person, aren't you? So we'll trust you on the numbers. So it's the judgments that underlie those, and particularly the choice of difficult parameters. And here, I would say correlations. very little body of evidence in terms of prospective correlation. I mean, you may be able to draw up lots of information on retrospective correlation, but prospective correlation is one step further in terms of judgment, and that may be a key sensitive parameter. What is the basis of your choice? Is it just a central value? Is it just an average? Have you just guessed? Have you just checked for its sensitivity, and if it's not sensitive to it, ignored it? All those points need to be put across. And sometimes this isn't always possible, because when you start quantifying sensitivities, if you quantify too many sensitivities, it just becomes a bit too cloudy. You're moving too far where the number could be anything really, and not necessarily providing enough of a space where you really do believe enough work has been done within all the model areas. Extreme example of that would be to actually show hurricane frequencies sort of doubling, trebling, quadrupling, etc., etc. And yes, there's a big range, and you get to 5 times the capital level. So what do they do with it? Not a lot. So it's not an easy task. Joining the dots is hard. Explaining it to the regulators is a little bit easier, in the sense that you can use more extensive documentation. Boards do not necessarily have the time to actually go through every item of detail. They have to rely on parts of the management to do particular bits of work, and they will ask questions to confirm that that work has been done. So the documentation part of it is certainly easier with regulators. Plus, the regulators will tend to have more experts who would understand the detail more, because that's their area. So I think the challenge is definitely more with the boards at this point. Thank you.